Hello, and welcome to another episode of Boundless Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we have another amazing guest introduced to you now. Dr. Ian Campbell is the Baszucki Research Fellow in Metabolic Psychiatry at the University of Edinburgh. He has a PhD in Global Health from the University of Edinburgh and is a principal investigator on a pilot trial of a ketogenic diet for bipolar disorder at the Division of Psychiatry within the Center for Clinical Brain Sciences. Dr. Campbell has lived experience of bipolar disorder type 2 and has experienced the benefits of ketogenic metabolic therapy for over 7 years. Growing evidence from the fields of genomics, epigenomics, metabolomics, and transcriptomics points to a significant biological overlap between metabolic dysfunction, such as insulin resistance, obesity, and type 2 diabetes, and severe psychopathology, including psychosis, mania, and severe depression, and this awareness has been recently gaining popularity. Dr. Campbell is also a composer interested in the intersection between bipolar disorder, creativity, and music. He has previously worked for 5 years as a music producer for the global interactive entertainment company Rockstar Game, which are the creators of Grand Theft Auto and Red Dead Redemption, among others, and also an assistant to film composer Harry Gregson-Williams. Dr. Ian Campbell, what an absolute honor it is to welcome you to Boundless Body Radio.
It's great to be here. Thank you for that very embarrassing introduction.
You've done a lot of things. I left a lot of things out of that introduction. I do just want to say it was so very cool a few months ago to see an article done by NPR that was all about metabolic psychiatry and to see that you were featured. You were the first person talked about in that article. What was that like?
Yeah, that was a big surprise. It was great to see the work getting recognized. We were just saying before the podcast started that not so long ago, I had to work a day job to be able to do this research and to be interested in this field. I worked till 2 a.m. almost every night reading papers, trying to write papers and understand about this. And it came out of my personal experience with bipolar and ketosis that goes back about 8 years now. And so to suddenly see this on the front page of a newspaper or like in a major media outlet and to have a radio show about it was really exciting, and it was a real surprise, I think, to everyone that this is picking up so much momentum. So it's I feel it's driven by a patient movement. It's patients experiencing these benefits and wanting them to be recognized, and I think that's always a really positive thing in psychiatry when patients get involved with research in that way to try to bring new perspectives and new insights into the condition.
Yeah, we'll be sure to tag that article. It also featured lots of different doctors in the field, like Dr. Georgia E., Dr. Chris Palmer, both of whom we've hosted on the show before, and all their amazing work. And you're right, this work is emerging. It is getting out. I just got back recently from the Collaborative Science Conference down in Las Vegas, hosted by Dave Feldman and the Citizen Scientist Foundation. And it was interesting. When I got there, I kind of noticed like two kind of major groups of people that were there. There were the people that were kind of interested in lipids and lipid metabolism, and then there was this also subgroup that was interested in metabolic ketogenic therapies. And I realized after being there for a little while that a lot of it was such a crossover, because you have so many people who were there because they found ketogenic metabolic therapies to be very helpful for them. And as a byproduct of that, also saw that their cholesterol may have gone like really, really high. And so there's a lot of people seeking answers in both of those fields. But it was quite amazing to see how many people were there, how many people had amazing and genuine questions, and how smart, generally speaking, the lay audience was. I was very impressed.
Yeah, I've got so much respect for Dave Feldman, Nick Norris, Adrian Sutomoto, all those guys researching cholesterol. It's such important work because it's such a barrier to so many people, the kind of cholesterol issue, and to understand how you can be healthy and to thrive while still having these kind of different cholesterol markers when you're on a ketogenic diet is so important for so many people, and especially people coming to this from the mental health side. I think mental health brings a lot of people to this because the brain and the central nervous system are so sensitive to energy deficit and kind of insulin resistance. And we're only really learning about that in the kind of recent decades. For a long time, the central nervous system and brain was kind of seen there to be kind of insulin independent, and it didn't really experience the same types of metabolic dysfunction. But it seems kind of crazy that this wasn't recognized earlier on, that metabolic dysfunction affects the brain just as much as the rest of the body. And I think in time we'll probably learn that this significantly affects the brain because it's so energy sensitive. There's kind of three main organs in the body that are using very high rates of metabolism, and the brain is one of them. It's in the top three most metabolically active organs in the body. So people experiencing mental health symptoms and improvement on ketogenic diet, you know, it might be indicating that this is a particularly sensitive organ to energy deficit, and they might even experience those symptoms before they experience some of the physical symptoms. So, but then when they reach that, again, the cholesterol is a bit of a sticking point for many people. So it's such important, exciting research. And it's nice to see the intersection of kind of people interested in mental health and physical health, because it's a divide that's kind of run through psychiatry for a long time, the split between psychiatry and neurology and neuroscience and psychiatry. These are considered kind of separate disciplines, and you know, it really goes like way back in history, back to Sigmund Freud was working in neurology. He was a trained neurologist at the start of his career. He wasn't someone into psychoanalysis, but he eventually kind of became disappointed with the lack of progress in neurology, and he went into psychoanalysis to try and help people with mental health problems. And then the neurologists in the sort of school of Emil Kraepelin kept following this biological basis of mental illness. So there was these kind of like two disciplines of mind and body studying mental health. And I think metabolic psychiatry is the first time we're seeing those kind of come together again, where it's the body and the brain are not separate. They're part of the same holistic system. And you can't have health in one without it affecting the lack of health in one without it affecting the other. So to see conferences like COSAI, where there's people interested in both mental health and physical health, and the union of those, it's really exciting.
Yeah, I'll paraphrase Dr. Georgia Ead by saying, last time I checked, I'm pretty sure the head was connected to the body. Like, it's a really good point. Yeah. We need to start looking at this a little bit more holistically. And when I'm trying to set this up and explain it to somebody how difficult this situation could be, I can talk about the person, a really good friend of mine who sat next to me during the entire conference, Robin Dobbins, also diagnosed bipolar. And, you know, she found eventually metabolic therapies using a ketogenic and eventually carnivore diet. And when she did, all of her symptoms of bipolar went away. But as that happened, her cholesterol elevated to very, very high levels. As she started to reintroduce carbohydrates, her cholesterol will go right back down to normal, but symptoms of bipolar start to come back. And so that's a person that has to make a very, very difficult decision. She spent over a decade medicated, basically sedated. She could go that route. She could go the route of, you know, bringing her cholesterol back down to a normal level by reintroducing carbohydrates and have symptoms of bipolar. Or she can continue following this research and hope that this turns out the way we all hope it does, that cholesterol is not this crazy harmful thing that we thought it was. And so again, as I'm trying to explain that to people, those are the kind of decisions that people in your situation have to make, and they're very real decisions.
Robin's amazing. I spoke to her about that, and she always had a huge remission of her symptoms. And for someone who lives with bipolar, it's so debilitating as a condition. You know, many people, you can't leave the house for months on end. You're really incapacitated in a way that is hard for people to understand. So when you experience that lifting, you think, oh my gosh, I have the potential to have a real life and to maybe work a job and have a family or have friends, or, you know, these things are so unusual for many people with bipolar to have. And so you almost feel like any trade-off is worth it. And what's exciting, though, is that maybe keto, you know, keto has many benefits for your physical health as well as your mental health. And I think for me, it was the weight loss plus the mental health symptom remission that convinced me this is the healthiest state for my body, because I'd always struggled to lose weight and I could never shift any significant amount. And when you have a psychiatric condition, the medications are often causing you to gain much more weight. So things like olanzapine and some of the kind of first line medications for mental illness cause you to gain like 20, 30, 40 pounds sometimes in the first few months of taking them. And that's kind of a universal, you know, a problem with people with serious mental illness, is you're kind of, with many of the treatment paradigms we have, you trade your physical health for your mental health. And it seems like there should be a way that's not the case, where you can have, you know, mental health and physical health at the same time. And I think, again, it goes back to that split I was describing between psychiatry and the other sort of medical sciences, that it was like, we're going to treat the brain as this completely separate organ, and then we're going to treat the body in a different way. And you inevitably then end up with a treatment paradigm where you have to trade a bit of your mental health for your physical health, or vice versa. And it's hard to say where this started. I've always been trying to understand, why did this kind of split between brain and body happen? And I think it goes way back in history to the sort of like philosophical roots of Western medicine, of Descartes, where the mind and the body are completely separate. And this is how we kind of view, and this kind of informed a lot of psychiatry and the medical healthcare system. So it's no wonder that we end up with this kind of paradigm where you can't have physical and mental health at the same time. And what we're trying to point out in our keto research and advocacy is that you can improve your mental and physical health at the same time. And many patients like Robin are talking about this and describing it. And it's kind of a new paradigm for mental health, is this concomitant like improvement in physical and mental health at the same time. So it's really exciting for patients, the idea that you could have that, because many of them are very much resigned to the idea, I'm going to have a lot of weight gain and metabolic dysfunction, but at least I'll be out of hospital and stable. And the idea that you could have both is really exciting for patients.
Yeah, very remarkable. And I love what you said there, and that's a perfect segue. When I was at this conference, I was able to hear the presentation done by Matt Bazzucchi, the son of the Bazzucchis. I really wanted to meet all of them, but they always had a crowd around them, and so it was very difficult to meet them in person. But to see his presentation, he talked for 15 minutes, and in 15 minutes, he could hardly get through all the things that he suffered with, all the different medications, what it was like. And I think what you said was very wise. Most of us probably don't understand what it's like to suffer with bipolar. And I guess I really underappreciated how difficult it was. You having gone through that experience, if we could go a little bit deeper into your own history with this stuff, if you could try to describe, like, what was it like when you started to notice mental issues? You know, I hear that you're either super productive and you can do all these amazing creative things, and then all of a sudden, like you were just describing, like you can't get out of bed. Like, what was your life like as this started to kind of unfold for you?
Yeah, so I mean, bipolar disorder is an unusual condition because you just go through periods where you're completely drained of all energy and ability to function, and your mind becomes very dark, and it's really like a physical feeling of the energy being drained from your body to the point where it's almost like a feeling of complete physical and mental exhaustion. But it's worse than that. The way I describe it to people is it's almost like being deprived of oxygen by just enough percentage that you can stay alive, but you're still, that really is what it feels like in depression. And it's hard to imagine that, but you know, people who do extreme sports and reach states of physical exhaustion where their lactate is building up in their system, this is the same kind of thing that happens in bipolar during depression. The lactic acid in the bloodstream goes up to very high levels compared to a normal person. And you're physically and mentally exhausted, and you feel like you're really, the best way I can describe it is like you just cannot get enough oxygen from the environment, but you continue living enough survival, just enough energy in your body to survive. And you go through this sometimes for weeks and months at a time. It's really remarkable that anyone survives it. But people become very determined with this because you also have up periods where then your energy is very high and you're able to physically exercise more. People engage in, taking on a new career or new hobbies. And this can be really destabilizing for people if they're not able to kind of be consistent with their work or with their career or their relationships. And in rare cases, people can harness this very effectively to do some amazing pieces of work. But for the vast majority of people, it causes their life to be very difficult to live. So I come from a family where there's these kinds of conditions. My uncle, unfortunately, committed suicide, had a mental disorder, and my grandfather had dementia. And it often is this way with bipolar. It runs in the family. And the first time I noticed it was when I was a teenager and I was at the beach with my grandparents, and I could see that people were playing on the beach, and there was it was a really sunny day and things were fine. And I knew that people were having a great time, but I felt like I was behind this like glass wall where I was not able to experience it. And I didn't have the neurochemistry, I just could not experience the feeling of what that's like to be at the beach. And I knew there was something really wrong. And as time went over, my episodes got more and more severe to the point where, I would really sort of, it becomes very difficult with bipolar depression because the suicidal thinking becomes so rapid and intense, and you really are sort of struggling to stay alive in some of the depressions. But I was really fortunate to have a wonderful family, my father, my wife, people that helped me through these kinds of times. And so eventually I came to a point where I realized like I will not survive this condition if I don't do something. And I made this little Google Doc. I showed this at Metabolic Health Summit earlier this year, and I called it Fight. And it was like, I'm going to fight to try and survive this thing. And so I just looked at every possible thing that I could do to increase my chances of survival and put them in a Google Doc. And one of those was just losing weight. I thought, I have to try to lose weight and become as physically healthy as I possibly can to survive this. And so one of the things I ended up trying was the Atkins diet, because I'd read that this helps with weight loss. And I started doing it. And it was just a week or a couple of weeks into doing this Atkins approach. I remember sitting on the bus and I was looking out the window, and I knew that my mind was completely different to how I'd ever experienced it before, but it was also completely calm and rational, and I was able to think clearly and I felt at peace. And I thought, I don't know what, I couldn't make sense of what I was experiencing at the time. And over a few weeks, I realized that I was going into ketosis when I was on this. I didn't know about ketosis or what it meant at the time, but I was watching podcasts and trying to understand why my mind was feeling so different. And I realized that this was my brain going into ketosis, my body going into ketosis. And this was what was bringing on this kind of remission of my depression. And this was really remarkable to me, because I never understood what it, I couldn't remember since being a kid what it felt like to feel normal. I was looking out the window and seeing nature, and I felt just kind of a gentle kind of happiness and peace. And I thought, oh, this is what it's like to feel normal. Like, this is what people, this is what it's like for, it's not this constant state of kind of suffering. You're able to enjoy the small things about daily life, small pleasures, and they really have a kind of a texture and a kind of happiness to them that I wasn't familiar with. And so that really got me thinking about this. And I started researching, found podcasts like Dom D'Agostino, people like Dave Asprey were talking about this. This is about 8 years ago. And I realized that it was ketosis. And the thing that actually convinced me was starting to take MCT oil, because I would take an MCT oil supplement. And within half an hour, my wife would say, like, you seem completely different. Like, you know, you were like totally depressed, that your facial expression, everything has changed in the half an hour since you've taken this. And I realized this was the ketones that were causing the shift in symptoms. So then I really just decided I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to understand this, because this is totally remarkable. I've tried so many things to be well and nothing has helped me. And this going into ketosis is making the biggest difference of anything that I've tried. It's not a cure. I'm not cured of having bipolar. It's a lifelong, you know, it's probably for many people a lifelong condition, although we hope that we can develop cures for or such effective treatments as like a cure. But for me, you know, I have this condition, and this is the most effective treatment I've ever tried. So I don't actually take any, I just use ketogenic diet for my treatment for this condition. And it's the most effective thing that I've used, but it also helps my physical health. When I first did it, I lost about 40, 50 pounds doing it. And so it was really intriguing to me, this improvement in physical health alongside mental health. And I decided that I'm going to study this. And so I started looking, started publishing papers and doing research and looking for funding for, you know, a pilot trial to understand what was happening in this condition. So that's kind of how I came to it.
That's absolutely remarkable. I was fortunate that I'd never had any serious mental health issues. And I had been, you know, in the ketogenic world for quite a number of years, you know, understanding that fat was okay for you and that kind of thing. But I remember my transition into a carnivore diet about 5 years ago, where I can experience something similar. Obviously, this would be just a small fraction of what you experienced. But I remember It was about 2 weeks in where everything just kind of calmed down, and like there was no anxiety. Like life was just life. And all of a sudden, like, I noticed birds and trees and things that were all around me all the time. And they were there before, but now there was like something different about them. And just to have that level of stress drop off was life-changing for me. I can't even imagine what that was like for you. And I'm curious, when you were first getting started trying to follow the Atkins diet, what did your diet actually look like? Could you say that it was very, very ketogenic? Like, what kinds of things were you eating?
That's good. That's cool that you experienced that same transition. Like, the feeling of peace in your mind is quite foreign to a lot of people. And it makes me wonder how much anxiety in the world is caused by some kind of metabolic dysfunction in the brain, because it really makes your brain, you know, kind of, it's like the static on a TV, you know. That's how I describe it when I'm not in ketosis. And then when you're in ketosis, it's just like calm and you can think clearly. So when I started the diet, I wish I had a more sophisticated approach to my health back then, but I bought the kind of like Atkins diet, the new Atkins diet book, because I didn't know anything about anything with physical health at all. So I bought the Atkins diet book and I just followed it to the letter, but I increased the fats quite a lot because I'd read from people this was beneficial. And so I was increasing the fat to quite a high degree and kind of accidentally intermittent fasting as well. So I realized that even though Atkins is traditionally kind of high protein, I was essentially doing a kind of ketogenic diet slash Atkins. And then when I realized it was the MCT oil that made me realize that ketosis was making the difference, and that's when I started researching keto and switched to full ketogenic diet. And that was giving me much more benefit than just Atkins alone. So, and I always use MCT oil supplements alongside keto. I've always found that beneficial. So yeah, the start was kind of a higher protein one. And then when I realized what ketosis was doing, I kind of moved to a full ketogenic diet. So it's like seizure control type 80% fat ketogenic diet. Although lately I do a more MCT oil modified ketogenic diet where I've a slightly higher protein, but using MCT oil as well.
I see. Okay. Now, when I think of low carbohydrate diets, I think of like a family of lots of different diets where, you know, you find carnivore, you find keto diets with a restricted amount of protein. Some people can withstand more protein, like you were saying. I think of also mental health, and you can divide this into even, you know, people who are vegetarian, like Hannah Warren, who's vegetarian, eats some eggs, but has had relief with her bipolar as well by doing a low carbohydrate, high fat diet. Can you talk about what a ketogenic diet means for somebody dealing with mental health? Because this is where I think there's a difference between like, okay, you're doing keto for, you know, body composition, weight loss, and that's good. Like, we want to be able to do that as well. But there's also like this next level of like, okay, now we're not screwing around anymore. What is that ketogenic like for people that have mental disorders?
Yeah, so it's worth mentioning that this was developed in part as a therapy for epilepsy. It's been used for over 100 years. There's about 13 randomized controlled trials showing it reduces seizures. And what's really interesting is that the treatments used to treat seizure and epilepsy are also the same kinds of treatment used to treat bipolar disorder. So the anticonvulsant medications used to treat epilepsy and seizure are used as first-line treatments in bipolar disorder in many cases. And I think that's a really interesting link between the conditions because there's a lot of kind of comorbidity between them. They're kind of episodic in nature. They have similar biomarkers. So there's a lot of links between epilepsy and bipolar. And I think that so when you see another kind of epilepsy therapy like ketosis, ketogenic diet, coming to play for bipolar, it really has a lot of scientific context for why this might be considered to be useful. But the medical therapeutic version of ketogenic diet, like you're saying, people like Brett Scher and Hannah Warren have been highlighting recently in Metabolic Mind that this is absolutely a different kind of thing to doing like a kind of a fad ketogenic diet that you read about in many websites online. This is a kind of medical intervention that has to be treated as such. And so in epilepsy, they work with dietitians and they have a very strict form of ketogenic diet, typically kind of 80% plus high fat. And they measure ketone levels and they try to make every effort to ensure that people don't go out of ketosis, at least very strictly for a year or 2 years. So that type of ketogenic diet is a totally different thing to just doing a keto diet and hoping for the best. It's really, you're working with skilled people. In this case, I always recommend that people approach a psychiatrist and a dietitian to do this properly. And this is how we've done it in our research, is to have a trained psychiatrist and a dietitian supervising patients. And I only hear from people that do well when they take this approach. And many people, and I understand the inclination is to feel like, oh, it's a diet, I can just do it. Like, it's so simple, but it really isn't when you do it for a serious mental condition, because there's so many things that you have to be aware of that can throw you out of ketosis, that can disrupt ketosis. And, you know, learning that by trial and error can be a really dangerous process, especially if you're, you know, if you're trying to adapt your medication because of this therapy. So you really have to work with a psychiatrist and a dietitian to do it safely. And when I hear from people, the people that do the best are almost, I'd say 99, if not all people that have contacted me that have done well, that have taken this approach of working with a psychiatrist and dietitian. So I can't recommend that enough as an approach to this and treating it like a medical therapy.
That's another really good segue. I was going to ask you, are you comfortable at this point with all the research you've done, all the experiences you've had in this field, to be as comfortable and confident saying essentially what I'm going to paraphrase Chris Palmer saying, basically like every disease in psychiatry is somewhat related to mitochondria, metabolism, some type of a failure in metabolizing energy in the brain. Are you comfortable kind of saying that at this point?
I think that there's a lot of evidence for metabolic dysfunction across most serious and most neuropsychiatric conditions have some component of metabolic dysfunction. And my specific focus is on bipolar disorder, where it's really, there's a long history of research into mitochondrial dysfunction in bipolar disorder. There's many decades going back showing that this is like a primary issue at the root of bipolar disorder. And it's been summarized in papers like by people like Cato and Kim. And there's modern researchers like Anna Andresia that are focused on mitochondrial dysfunction, Martin Picard, others that are looking at mitochondrial dysfunction for these conditions. And in bipolar, it's also a very energy-specific condition. If you read the earliest descriptions of it, going back to Emil Kraepelin in the 18th century, they're describing it as a condition where patients are full of energy and then completely deprived of energy and unable to function for long periods of time. And this kind of dynamic is, from a patient perspective, so central to the condition. It's like the energy, the high energy during mania. There was a review of, I think it was done by Andrew Nierenberg, of about 500 bipolar patients, and he asked them, what is the thing that most predicts the onset of mania or depression to you? And they said changes in energy levels, sort of high energy and low energy changes, were what made them know they were changing into a mood state. So from a patient perspective, it certainly feels very much like an energy condition. There's a huge body of research on bipolar and mitochondrial dysfunction, which substantiates this at the kind of cellular level. And then there's also a lot of circadian research from people like my colleagues, Professor Daniel Smith, that shows that this is a kind of seasonal dysregulation as well. In the spring, people become manic and have more energy, and in the winter, they tend to become more depressed and have less. And so I think across so many parameters, this is a kind of energy disorder with mitochondrial dysfunction at the heart. So from the perspective of the condition I study, this certainly fits very well with the evidence that this is a kind of energy disorder, which inevitably involves mitochondrial function, glucose metabolism. And so we're starting to learn more and more about this, and it's becoming increasingly clear that there's this kind of energy dysfunction component to many neuropsychiatric conditions.
Yeah, I mean, I know we have to be very, very careful about the way that we talk about this, and we can't say that this is going to work for everybody or this is going to be the magic bullet. What my experience and the things I'm observing is, if somebody is willing to give the diet a try and really willing to do it and stick with it, and maybe for, you know, longer than they like, but to really, really stick with it, I don't see many, if any, you know, cases where this isn't really working for people. So I really appreciate that. You've mentioned something earlier. I was just talking to my client about this, actually, MCT oil. What is it about MCT oil that is so beneficial? This person just started using it in their coffee. They asked me if I use it, and I say, you know what? I still really enjoy using it in my coffee in the mornings, and I notice a really mental kind of effect. About 10 minutes after I start taking it, I feel like my brain is on, and I feel just kind of good. It's not like jittery. It's not like a rush of energy. It's just kind of really level. What is MCT? What does that stand for, and what is that doing specifically in the brain?
So MCT oil is these medium chain triglycerides. They've been used in epilepsy as a kind of way to induce ketosis exogenously without doing ketogenic, what sometimes alongside ketogenic diet, sometimes on their own. And they basically convert into ketones such as beta hydroxybutyrate in the body, and they basically put the body into a state of ketosis as a supplemented form. And this can be really useful for periods where people, sometimes children with epilepsy, want to eat more carbs in their diet, but they also want to stay in ketosis. And there's good evidence that the MCT oil supplemented diet is as good for seizure reduction in many cases than the full ketogenic diet. So it's a really useful tool for people if they want to maintain ketosis while having more flexibility with their diet, or if they have, they fall out of ketosis for some reason. And I definitely experienced the same thing as you describe. It really boosts the brain. And there's a kind of story about that you could tell, that we're kind of only exploring at the moment to discover whether this is the case. But I think we really changed our diet so substantially. The agricultural revolution introduced massive introduction of wheat. And then we brought into that also sugar and ultra processed foods and disruption to circadian rhythms and all these things that affect our metabolism so badly. And we've understood a huge amount about this in the peripheral tissues of the body, like about diabetes and atherosclerosis and all non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, all these kind of physical issues. But we've never really considered what this does to the brain and the central nervous system. And this is kind of, it seems like you say, crazy that this wasn't considered more, but clearly this metabolic dysfunction must have some impact on the brain and the central nervous system. And maybe this is what's driving some of this increase in the rates of mental health problems worldwide. There was a report in The Guardian this week saying that of all health conditions, neurological conditions are the fastest rising in the global burden of disease. And so there's something driving a massive increase in neurological illness and psychiatric illness. And it doesn't seem like our genes just suddenly, shifted into some new mode. There's something in our environment that seems to be pushing this kind of increase in mental health. And so I think a really interesting thing to look at is, when someone takes an MCT oil and experiences this, the brain lighting up and them feeling good again, maybe they've been deprived of this evolutionary fuel source that they should be receiving all the time. And this is just them getting reintroduced to it. in the same way that if you took sunlight away from someone for a long time and they suddenly saw the sun, they would feel so much better and they would become so much healthier. And maybe I think MCT oil is a bit like this. It's giving people exposure to ketones again, sometimes for the first time in a very long time. And a great example of that was there was this trend, I'm sure it's still happening, but the people would put MCT oil in their coffee, like a bulletproof coffee was when it was called when I first found it. And so many people write about how that's helped them with their thinking and cognition. And it's just a little window into ketosis for people for the first time. So it's a really, MCT oils can be a really good way to introduce someone to ketosis and show them the effects of what it can be like. But there's no substitute for a full healthy ketogenic diet. But for me, they've been a very useful tool.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that. I think back on the story of Dr. Mary Newport that she's told us on our show, where her husband, they weren't into changing their diet at that time. They were just starting to learn about things. And so she was sneaking coconut oil into his oatmeal, I believe. And so, yeah, it wasn't as good as changing the entire diet, but at least you were providing coconut oil, which a component of coconut oil is MCT. And, you know, we see the pictures of the clock test that her husband drew over the course of, I want to say it was like 35 days, where the first drawing, I mean, a two-year-old could do a better job drawing a clock than that to win 35 days, you definitely recognize that it's a clock. And that just came from just adding that in. And that to me is a really interesting kind of demonstration of how ketones are used in the body. They really are kind of supply driven. If you have more of them, you'll use more of them and have better energy. That's a little bit different than glucose in the body.
Definitely. It's I met Mary recently at the Metabolic Health Summit this year, and it was really cool to meet her because Alzheimer's is a very advanced stage of cognitive decline, and you know, the mental health conditions like bipolar were originally called dementia praecox, like the kind of precursor to dementias, because it's the kind of decline of brain function that can happen over a very long time. And many people with mental health conditions, unfortunately, can develop these things later on in life. And I'm very hopeful for ketogenic therapy and metabolic therapies that they prevent this kind of dynamic and kind of give people the opportunity to heal their brain and recover, like we see in epilepsy with children. So I think that the kind of restoration of brain energy, you can see it in Alzheimer's in these ketone studies and brain imaging and in patients. People like Stephen Kinane have demonstrated with MCT oils and mild cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's that it restores brain metabolism. And I think that this is kind of also what people experience at a kind of earlier stage when they have some of these mental health conditions, is less severe dysfunction, but you still have an opportunity at that age to kind of repair it and use ketosis as a way to let the brain repair itself. One of the hopeful things for me is in epilepsy, when you do this with children, they have, if they do it strictly for 2 years, a significant proportion of them will go into complete remission for the rest of their life of epilepsy. I mean, isn't that incredible? The idea that someone could be having like 50, 100 seizures a day, and they are able to live the rest of their life with no seizures if they stick to this for a year or 2 years. And I think at that age, the brain, if you give it the right environment, can do a lot of healing. And I'm hopeful that in mental health conditions, we'll find something similar, that if you introduce this to young people where they can do a year or two strict years of metabolic repair in the brain by doing something like ketosis, they can never have to worry about mental illness again. For me, I only found this when I was kind of in my late 20s, and I think that and so I have to do it all the time to experience the benefits of ketosis. Just like someone with epilepsy, I have to stay in it all the time. But I do hope we can introduce these ideas. If we go through RCTs and this is a good treatment approach for young people, there's a lot of hope that this could help people avoid some of the complications of mental illness throughout their life.
It's so incredible. You're right. It is incredible for these kiddos who can get rid of it altogether. And when I find something in science that I feel like is not true, the longer that the hypothesis goes, the more there's holes and paradoxes and a lack of mechanisms and a lack of case studies. Cholesterol in particular, we had this idea that high cholesterol killed people. You know, not a bad idea. It's worth investigating. But as time goes on, we're realizing that people that have high cholesterol, high LDL cholesterol, people with low cholesterol, low LDL cholesterol, they get heart attacks just as much as people with high cholesterol. Yes. And there's just so many holes and question marks. And something like this is like the opposite. The more we study this, the more the case studies all align, the more the mechanisms all make sense. It just becomes more and more and more true. And not only, like you explained earlier, not only was this great for mental health, it's great for so many other things. Like you can reverse diabetes, you can, you know, prevent all kinds of metabolic dysfunction. It's good for everything. Seemingly everything gets better on this. And to think that you found this diet just for weight reduction and saw these amazing health benefits, to me, it's just a great indicator that this we're on the right path. We're heading the right direction with this.
Yeah, I mean, and some people, they get suspicious of it because they say, well, how could it help so many things? And I genuinely understand that in most areas of medicine, that's a, you know, it could be seen as concerning if it's a cure-all or something like that. But this is a different kind of situation we're talking about, because we drastically shifted the human diet away from its evolutionary history. And almost everyone in Western society is exposed to that, this like massive increase in carbohydrate consumption, sugar, ultra-processed foods. And we know that this is causing diabetes, type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome in hundreds of millions of people around the world. The WHO are reporting on it as a kind of almost like a global epidemic of metabolic syndrome. And so to think that this doesn't have some impact on the brain is crazy. And there's two avenues that have shown that this metabolic dysfunction is so significant throughout the population. And one is that the people doing fasting and ketosis are experiencing these benefits, but also the I'm not someone who takes weight loss drugs, but you can see the popularity is showing like how many people are struggling with their metabolic health. And this is being, you know, this is one way that this is kind of expressing our culture, is that they're trying to fix this with medications. But I think that both these insights highlight that the hundreds of millions of people are experiencing metabolic dysfunction in their body. And now we're starting to understand that this is also happening in the brain. And what does this mean? You know, if you haven't got advanced Alzheimer's or dementia, what does it mean at the earlier stages when you have this metabolic dysfunction in the brain? And to me, it feels a lot like what happens in mental health conditions. And from a scientific perspective, it looks like what happens in mental health conditions. So, yeah, I think that if you have massive metabolic dysfunction in the population, which we absolutely know is the case, introducing a very powerful metabolic intervention like ketosis would help in all kinds of organs in the body. In the heart, is going to help with atherosclerosis, preventing atherosclerosis, in the, you know, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And then in the brain, maybe it helps to prevent mental health conditions. And this is one of the expressions of it. So to me, what you're saying seems to make complete sense, that this could have effects on so many different organs of the body that are affected by metabolic dysfunction.
Pretty incredible stuff. It must be so meaningful to you to go through this personally and now also be involved in the research and getting this message out there to more people. So tell us specifically about the research you're conducting. What have you done and what have you shown so far?
So we're really fortunate to have supported a pilot study of a ketogenic diet for bipolar disorder. And again, for many years, it was impossible to find people interested in this research and wanting to support it. But the Buzuki family, their son, Matt, as you know, from the COSAI conference, he was describing his experience with, and he had a similar experience where he had remission of symptoms going into ketosis. And he tried many, many different things, all kinds of different treatments. It'd be a great person to have on the podcast to share about that, because it was really an epic journey through, I think, over like 30 or 40 different medical treatments. And eventually they ended up working with Dr. Palmer and Denise Potter, Beth Supek, and others that were supporting him do a ketogenic diet. And this led to remission of symptoms when nothing else that they tried over this, you know, multi-year period had worked. So it was a real surprise to them. And I'd put up this YouTube video summarizing my kind of research on it that I've been doing myself for a long time and calling for a trial to happen. And they reached out and funded our pilot study and later also my fellowship so that I could research this more. And so we did a pilot study with 27 people with bipolar disorder who went on a ketogenic diet. And this was a pilot study to kind of pave the way for future randomized controlled trials. And then the purpose of pilot studies is to assess, is this safe, is it effective, is it feasible, and what kinds of considerations do we need to have for larger trials. And so the main thing was people said, you know, you can't get people with bipolar to do ketosis. And we saw over 91% adherence as measured by daily ketone level throughout the study, which is fantastic, showing that people with mental illness can do this. They enjoy doing this and it is feasible for them to reach ketosis. And then we looked at how does the daily ketone level correlate to the symptoms. So we've published this as a preprint you can find online. It's in my Twitter, and we'll have the publication coming out this year. And it shows that in the daily measurement of mood symptoms that we took alongside daily measurement of ketone and glucose levels, there was a correlation, a statistically significant correlation between the ketone level and improvements in mood, improvements in energy, and conversely, reductions in anxiety and impulsivity. And this is really interesting because you never see blood markers in psychiatry correlating to mental health symptoms in this kind of a way. It was quite a unique study. So I think this is a really interesting indication that this is helping people. And we had a washout period at the end of the trial where we said, please come off the diet and for 2 weeks we'll measure what happens when you come off the diet. And over a third of the participants said, we will not come off the diet because we're experiencing benefits from doing this. And this was, you know, so we had to try and understand what's happening with these participants. And I presented at Metabolic Health Summit this year some patient videos and experiences. But essentially, these participants had physical health benefits. So 95% of people lost weight. The kind of average was about 4.7 kilograms over 8 weeks, which is whilst on all the medications they normally take for like antipsychotics, anticonvulsants that cause weight gain, they were able to lose a substantial amount whilst taking those. And so these participants, we also drew their ketone levels over time. And you can see that the ketone level seems to track with their mental health symptoms over the course of the study, which is quite interesting because it might indicate that the ketone level is somewhat related to what's happening with the change in the symptoms. So this was obviously really exciting, and this prompted us to say, let's try and set up some wider metabolic psychiatry research. So we applied to the UK government as a medical research council, which is what defines kind of like the main, it's funded, many, I think over 20 or 30 Nobel Prize winning science projects. They're the most prestigious funder of science research, probably in Europe, certainly in the UK. And so we went to them as quite a mainstream kind of organization and said, you know, we want to learn more about the link between metabolism and mental health because it's a huge patient priority. We know that this is there's a great degree of interaction between metabolism and mental health that we see in population health data. And so along with the Bouzoukis, they've co-funded us to set up the first hub for metabolic psychiatry in the UK, which is really exciting because we're now going to do much more clinical trials, data research, genetic research, metabolomics, to really kind of like go to the next stage and understand in larger numbers and bigger sample sizes in more detail what is the interaction between metabolism and mental health. I think it's really great in science when these situations happen where you have a new field of research that patients are highlighting as important. Then a funder comes along and funds a unique study, and this leads to a much larger research project. We now have five universities in the hub working together to try and understand these mental health and metabolic health links. So it's a very, and this is also paralleled by a center at Harvard for metabolic psychiatry, a center at Stanford for metabolic psychiatry. Many universities now launching metabolic psychiatry centers, and the Bouzoukis are really driving a lot of the funding behind this renaissance in research. And I think it's a really cool thing that this came from their own family experience with this condition, because many of the great advancements in kind of medical science come from families taking interest in a condition of someone they care very much about and kind of raising awareness about it and driving science. So I think it's a really exciting time in psychiatry because of this.
I just can't say enough about the Bouzouki family. I mean, what have all of us been complaining about in this space for so long? It's that these trials are not going to get done. There's no industry interest in any of this. Pharma doesn't care about this. The medical industry doesn't care about this. And we need to raise money for this. And this is why, you know, the work of Dave Feldman and his nonprofit and raising money is amazing. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it seems like the Bouzouki family comes in and is funding all of these projects. And it's absolutely incredible the work that they are doing. And these questions are getting answered all over the place. It's wonderful, all of their work. And I understand that for, you know, the pilot study, you needed to have a washout period, but I would be the same, man. If you told me to go off this diet, I'd be like, over my dead body. Absolutely not. I'm not going off of this.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I feel like. There's such a cost to me for going off the diet, and it's really quite, it happens quite quickly. And it's just not worth it. I think they're kind of like, it's hard to describe, but, you know, I'm like a functioning person. I'm an academic, I'm a father, but I'm not like that if I'm not in ketosis and I can't function anywhere near, like even a normal, just a kind of like, just at a normal level to get through the day. And so, for me, it's staying in ketosis all the time. It doesn't, people say like, oh, do you need discipline and do you need But it's almost like if you are having struggle, you know, if you're struggling to get oxygen and you've given an oxygen mask, you'll be kind of highly adherent to this oxygen mask because it's really helping you to live your life. And you know, that's obviously an extreme example, but in some ways, ketosis is a bit like that, where it gives you so much if you have this kind of metabolic dysfunction that it's not worth coming off it for many people. And other people cycle on and off and they have success with that. For me personally, I have to stay on it all the time.
Yeah, that's a really great analogy. I actually really love that. And you had the opportunity to present your work at different conferences, obviously going around and presenting them at low carbohydrate conferences. You know, that's a bit like putting a PowerPoint together, saying how great Manchester City is, presenting to a bunch of Manchester City fans. We're going to love that and we're going to cheer you on and say that's all great. Yeah. And again, COSI was that experience for me. Everybody was kind of in there for that reason. And so selectively, all of us are you know, going to approve this. But you've also had the opportunity to present this data at other conferences that were not necessarily low carbohydrate conferences, more kind of mainstream medical conferences. What experience has that been like for you and how has this been received? Sometimes I lose track of what this looks like to the outside, you know, space of this world. How is it being received?
Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing that up because that's something I'm very passionate about, is bringing this into spaces in psychiatry that wouldn't normally be aware of kind of metabolic health in this way. And so it's been really amazing. We went to ISBD, which is the biggest bipolar conference in the world. It's the largest, most prestigious bipolar conference. And they gave us a symposia, which is like one of the main events of that conference. And I presented with Shibani Sethi and Georgia Eads, results from her trial at Stanford, R1 at Edinburgh, and also Georgia Eads' paper from the Dr. Tanan study in France. And it was really remarkable how open and interested people were to this. I think it's just partly because in psychiatry, there's been so few major developments in the past kind of 50 years in terms of treatments that are widely available. There's maybe, you know, there's been tens of millions spent in research, but there's really hardly any new treatments that are accessible widely to patients that are kind of more effective. And it's kind of crazy that that's the case. There's so many other fields of medicine where we've made a lot of progress and psychiatry is really kind of stalled in comparison in many ways. So I think people are excited to hear about something that's new, and this kind of interface between physical and mental health is something everyone is interested in at the moment. So it really plugged into kind of this need for new ideas and new ways of thinking about mental illness and the physical mental health connection. And so it was really well received. And a lot of the researchers at that meeting are now launching their own keto studies, their own keto trials. Even people that were kind of initially quite skeptical about this have now really gone into this field and seen that we need to understand more about this, which is really exciting. And we're also going to the Royal College of Psychiatrists International Congress, this UK. It can't get any more, mainstream in terms of psychiatry than that, because these are the people who decide on psychiatric care in the UK. And none of them are kind of specifically educated, to my knowledge, maybe some of them are, but in ketosis or these kind of concepts. So it's really gratifying to go to these kind of conferences. And we had a symposia accepted at that conference, which I think is really exciting. And continually we're getting more and more interest in this field from kind of more mainstream scientific conferences and psychiatric conferences. And that's where I want to go, is into these more difficult areas to raise awareness about this, both as a patient and as a researcher.
Yeah, I love that. I'm sure they have the same kind of progression of questions that all of us have. Like when you first learn about this stuff, I'm sure they're concerned with eating that much fat and eating a lot of animal products, or, you know, what happens to the heart and cholesterol and all those things. Have you noticed that they have those questions that we all did in the beginning?
Yes, definitely. It's and they often come up. It was brilliant. I remember at ISBD, the cholesterol question came up, and thankfully Brett Sharon was in the audience, and he just stood up, and it was like watching someone who's prepared their whole life to play baseball just go up and knock it out of the park. You know, it's like he was born to answer this question. So I think it's been really, so those questions definitely come up, but then thankfully we have so much kind of knowledge about this through, learning about it through epilepsy and other fields that we, you know, have some good answers. And obviously the work of David Feldman, Nick Norris, Adrian Sotomuto, people like this are really kind of helping to address this now in a kind of a real rigorous scientific way. So yeah, those questions come up, but I think on the whole, people are just really interested that there's a new perspective, that this is coming from patients. I documented 174 patient reports or 164 patient reports in the British Journal of Psychiatry Open. It's really, and I've just done a survey that's over 100 people with bipolar disorder talking about their experience. So I think they're just interested and they want to understand what this is and can it be useful. And my impression in general of psychiatrists is that there are people who really want to help their patients and they want better tools and more effective tools. And they're really passionate about learning about anything new that can help their patients. And that's a really great thing for patients to have a kind of field that's like that.
Yeah. Well, I look at your work and it's so awesome to me to see the research being done and we see all these numbers and we're increasingly getting more and more people enrolled in these studies and the results seem more and more impressive over time. But at the end of the day, it's kind of what you were saying earlier, like my ability to be present with my kids and be a parent and be a husband and be a scholar and all of these different things are not possible. We need to remember that these are individual lives being improved all over the place. And there's that individual that's so, so, so important. And so I look at your work with something like BipolarCast, the podcast that you do, you kind of co-host. It must be wonderful to not only conduct the research and again, see the big picture numbers, but also understand all those individual stories and meet people like Robin and others out there who are suffering with this. That must be incredibly meaningful for you.
Yeah, it's fantastic to be able to hear from people who are experiencing the same thing. And it's something I was passionate about from like the very early stages. My first ever paper on this was just going online forums and doing a big analysis of all the people talking about this and showing just how many people with bipolar and many more with schizophrenia and other conditions also talking about this as an effective therapy, that it's helping their symptoms, it's improving their symptoms. And I just try and keep in communication with a lot of friends I have that are bipolar and in the bipolar community as much as possible and try and be plugged into like what are they finding useful, what are they finding helpful, and how can we support that? And so it's really gratifying that this is kind of aligned with their research interests. But there's a hard aspect as well, which is that many people are not aware of this, and you often get banned from like Reddit, for example. If you post about ketosis, I've been banned several times for just talking about it and sharing my own experience, which seems preposterous that, you know, someone can't share their own experience with what's worked for, you know, you're not recommending or saying do this, but just sharing your experience with the condition, and it gets banned because it's considered to be outside of the realm of possibility that this could be helpful. So there's something hard about that, seeing a lot of people really suffering and not having access to this information. But this is why we're doing the clinical trials and why you know, organizations like Metabolic Mind exist and the podcast we do, Keto Bipolar, to tell people about you know, that this is something that's helping others. And I think that's always a good thing when patients share what's helpful for them and what's not helpful for them and kind of spread the word about this. And I appreciate you featuring people with metabolic psychiatry on this podcast that's kind of really amplifying this to a wide audience. And it's only growing at the moment. There's more and more people becoming interested. And I just want to really, you know, do the really hard critical science and figure out, you know, what types of people can this help, and can you predict who those people are, and can we deliver this in more effective ways, and what are the ways we can kind of optimize this intervention? So it's a really interesting time for metabolic psychiatry.
It is. And we've got a long ways to go, like you said, but we are making progress and it is speeding up. And so I just look at your work and I'm so, so proud of you and everything that you've been able to accomplish. And I'm just so happy for you that you were able to find something better for your own life and improve that, but also share that with others. So we're just so grateful for you and your work and for the time that you took to be on our show today. Where would you like people to go to find you and connect with you and your work?
Thank you. I'm grateful to be on the show. It's a real honor considering all the amazing guests you've had on here. And the best place to find out about our work is we have a new metabolic psychiatry hub website, metabolicpsychiatryhub.com. I have the podcast, which you can find on YouTube, called BipolarCast, or type Keto Bipolar. And you can find my papers on PubMed under my name. I have a new paper in Nature and Molecular Psychiatry that's just come out, which is called The Metabolic Overdrive Hypothesis, which is kind of my thoughts about how ketosis works and why it helps with serious mental health conditions.
Excellent. We will link to all of that in the show notes so our listeners can find that. But for now, Dr. Ian Campbell, thank you so very much again for everything that you've gone through and to be able to come out on the other side and share that with everybody out there. It's just wonderful. And like I said, we've got a long ways to go, but I do believe it's catching on and this work is worthwhile. So thank you so very much for everything that you're doing in this field. And thank you for taking the time to be on our show today. We really appreciate you.
Thank you. It's great to speak to you.
Yeah, well, such an honor. And this has been another episode of Boundless Body Radio. As always, thank you so very much for listening to Boundless Body Radio. Hosting this podcast is seriously one of the most meaningful and joyous parts of my life. Even after 600 episodes of our show, I still get nervous before every interview that I do. But it does just bring me such joy to share some of my favorite people, the people that have taught me so much over the years, and to invite them on and ask them questions, and then to share that with you, the listener, is a super cool experience. I hope you've enjoyed the content of the show so far this year. I tried to start the year off with a mix of new guests and returning guests, some that are practically household names in the health and wellness space, and some inspiring people that may not be very well known now, but are certainly doing amazing work wherever they are. I'm just so grateful for all of our incredible guests. Remember that you can always go to our website to book a complimentary 30-minute session with us at myboundlessbody.com. On our homepage, one of the first things you'll see is a Book Now button where you can select a time to speak with us about your personal health and fitness plan. We don't have any set packages, products, supplements, or anything like that to sell you. People that do want to work with us simply pay for the time that they want, and that's about it. We've loved chatting with so many of you out there to bounce ideas off each other and try to offer any advice that we can. And seriously, as always, even if you book a spot just to say hello and introduce yourself, we absolutely love connecting with you, the listener, and our community. Be sure to check out our YouTube channel, which is also growing quite a bit, if you want to watch these full interviews and also shorter videos on more specific topics taken from these interviews as well. It's a fun way to interact with people who comment. We read and reply to every single YouTube comment we get, so be sure to subscribe to our channel and leave as many comments as you like. And of course, if you haven't already, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple. It is still the best way to make sure that the podcast gets out to more listeners. It only takes a moment to leave a review, and it's extremely meaningful to us. Cheers, and thank you again for listening to Boundless Body Radio.